I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Starting today across British Columbia until November 7th, there will be a series of events as part of Read Local BC, the second annual. It's a two-week-long campaign to promote British Columbians to read local books, visit local libraries and local bookstores. There'll be a number of events, including a free one next Wednesday, the 2nd of November, at 7 p.m. at the Book Warehouse at 4118 Main Street. It's called Writing the Body, and it'll feature previous guests to the program, Maureen Palmer and Mike Pond, and my guest now, Betsy Worland. Betsy's new book is Oscar of Between, a memoir of identity and ideas. It's gotten a lot of good notices. I'll get Betsy to tell us about this book, which looks at her experiences, her experience of in-betweenness from her childhood in the rural Midwest through to her first queer kiss in 1978, divorce, coming out, writing, the writing community here in Vancouver, and more. Betsy Worland is the author of 12 books of poetry, creative nonfiction, lyric, prose, including the bestseller Breathing the Page, Reading the Act of Writing. She has taught creative writing workshops for over 35 years and is on the faculty of Simon Fraser University's The Writer's Studio. She is the founder of the Vancouver Manuscript Intensive Program and for over 25 years has consulted and edited manuscripts professionally. Betsy was a 2016 recipient of the Mayor's Arts Award for Literary Arts. The website for more is at betsyworland.com. It's on there that Betsy cultivated an interactive salon where pieces of the manuscript for Oscar Between were posted and commented upon by salon readers. This new book is published by Caitlin Press's new imprint, Dagger Editions, and do drop in on the other Read Local BC events, Thursday the 3rd, also at the Book Warehouse on Main. Carolyn Ederson, Aaron Chapman, and Eve Lazarus will be presenting, and our pal Chris Brayshaw's Pulp Fiction Books at Main and Broadway will be hosting an evening with poets Tuesday, November 1st. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Betsy Worland. Ms. Worland, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Ah, happy to.
So this term, being a person of in-between, I mean, people will wonder what that means. And so I guess the first question for you is for you, what does that mean, and what are you contending with, if you will?
I was just at LitFest. It's a nonfiction festival in Edmonton, and this question came up there as well. The simple answer is that I've never been able to find one label that actually fit me. So I went through my life. I'm going to be turning 70 next month. No, 2 months from now. Mm-hmm. And I was always having to use like 3 or 4 or 5 labels to actually kind of really accurately signal the aspects of myself. And that's really tedious for me and other people. So I never actually had something that was a kind of signal in terms of who I am in the world and how I experience the world. And then I got this phrase came to me when I was going to London, England to celebrate my 60th birthday. And I, through a couple experiences there, which we'll probably go into later, like seeing this camouflage exhibit, mm-hmm. I suddenly had this come to me when I was walking down the street in London, a person of between, and I just thought, my God, that's it. That's who I am. It was an amazing revelation, and it just like went zing, you know. Felt great. And then I realized that once I had that label, mm-hmm. that was actually authentic for me, it changed how I was in the world. I think in one respect how I wrote this book, but also on just on the street experience of being in the world, because I started to realize, or recognize, I should say, other persons of between, which are a vast array of people. What I was asked at the Literary Festival was, because there's a line in the book that says, every talks about every group garrisons even if it's an aberrant group. Garrisons, it's norms, it's not between. Mm. So this fellow writer asked me about that, and I said, you know, the wonderful thing about a person of between and people of between is it's impossible to do that. It's impossible to categorize into one simple definition who people are between, because it's so diverse. So it was a big breakthrough for me, and it really... I find it really elating, and I find it very interesting. It's made me much more comfortable connecting in this very simple but meaningful ways with lots of other people in between, other persons in between. And there's an automatic kind of ease, you know, just on this kind of very simple level where there isn't that immediate wall that comes up of, oh, I'm not like you or you're not like me. You know, you have a different skin color than me, or you have a different lifestyle, or whatever. So there are always these moments in our lives that are always there that are opportunities to connect. You know, and we miss a lot of them because we get so narrowed down in terms of who we consider ourselves to be.
And so, for you, was it? It was something that you were always looking for. But how much of that desire for a label for yourself or an idea of yourself is, say, rooted in the experience of seeing how other people saw you and having...
Yes, it's true, because what happened, I went to the London and I looked at Time Out. This was when Time Out still was a viable entertainment, a culture magazine, and I was going flipping through it, seeing what was going on in London, and I came to the museum section, and there in the museum section was this announcement that the invention of military camouflage was at the Imperial War Museum, and I would normally have never gone there. It would be the last kind of place I'd ever go, but it just literally jumped out off the page, and I thought, I have to go see this. I don't know why, but I have to go see this. So, once I stepped into that exhibit, within a minute, I suddenly understood something that had puzzled me my whole life. And simply said, I realized I'd never learned the art of camouflage. I had never been taught it. And that this suddenly made sense to me of a dynamic that I have. Not all the time, but not infrequently either, was encountering throughout my life of people feeling a little bit uneasy or even a little suspicious of me because I wasn't sending off a really clear category signal. And so when you're encountering one another, and most of our encounters are based on those signals, and it makes things, you know, flow in a way, but it also makes things more, anxious in a way, because if that person isn't your category of person, you automatically are a bit on guard. So I suddenly realized this is what I've been encountering, not in everybody, but, you know, frequently, that I was making people feel uncertain who they were dealing with, and that it made them a bit on guard. So it really freed me in that sense, because since I've now realized I'm a person in between, I can't even explain it, but I have it doesn't happen nearly as much, that kind of uneasiness. It's really, really diminished it.
So when you'd go on a plane, for example,
yes,
and you'd get addressed one way or another.
Yes.
Before, would that, say, pose a problem for you? I mean,
Yes, that's in the book.
It'd bug you, right?
It talked to, you know, where it happens a lot is people, you know, within, you know, giving your boarding pass to the person right at the top of the gate.
Yeah.
To walking down the ramp into the plane, the first flight attendant who greets you, walking down the aisle to another flight attendant who greets you, I would never know if I was going to be called sir or ma'am. And it would sometimes go back and forth within seconds between from different people. And I used to correct people. And then I stopped doing that because it's a drag. And, you know, then once I realized, for them and me, so then once I realized this narrative life position of a person in between, I didn't matter anymore, you know. If I was addressed ma'am and sir within seconds apart, they were both accurate in a way because I have both of those kinds of qualities in me very much. I'm not aspiring to be or become or pass as a man, nor aspiring to always be and pass and be perceived as a woman. That's the spectrum of who I am. So it's made it much more easy, you know, like not a hassle anymore. Where it can be is on BC Ferries, because I don't know, there's something about it, but BC Ferries, when I go into the women's washroom, it's not unusual for a woman in the washroom to scowl at me or to say, you're the wrong washroom, you know, like, so that can be a little bit of a drag, but I don't have a kind of defensive reaction to it anymore. I just, you know, I'll smile or just say, actually, this is the right washroom, or make a joke, or, you know, it's just become much more easy.
See, what I'm thinking about is because I've read parts of your book that I've seen excerpted online. I just got the book this morning. And from hearing you now and seeing the other writing that I can get of yours online, what I've realized is just how hung up we are on how people look.
Yeah, really.
And so, I mean, the minute I see someone, I mean, the list of judgments in my head is composed, right?
Yes, exactly.
And in you know, as you just mentioned, going into the ferry bathroom, someone will say something. Because they have 15 other things that they're already thinking about in their head.
It's a jerk reaction.
Yeah. So do you think we'll ever get away from that in making judgments about people only through their appearance? I mean, and if we just get to know people, it won't really matter.
No.
Right?
No. Well, there's still differences between people, and they're important to respect and understand and be curious about. But there isn't nearly as much this knee-jerk reaction and this kind of closing down much of the time, because this whole categorization of life is very profound, and I find it really sad and really actually harmful to us as a human race. And I write about that in the book, and I'm very concerned about it. So I guess my sort of sense of it now is that there is a real problem with how intensely we are raised in any society, anywhere in the world, to behave and see the world through a genderization that we're taught. It's like a boot camp training, right? I understand what that's about in a lot of ways, and it's actually very functional, and it has some accuracy to it. I'm not saying that it has no accuracy, but it's so thorough, and it's so extreme in most cases that it becomes the kind of basis for all kinds of other isms, sexism, racism, classism, you name it. So that's where we get trained. As men and boys and girls, babies, boys and girls, and then we start importing that to other different people of difference from ourselves, and I think it's very harmful. So, what I've been interested in, Joe, is that I've had such a wide range of people, readers, interested in this book, it's been phenomenal. So there is something about this that does attract or appeal to people, and often people you wouldn't, for me anyway, I wouldn't necessarily assume it would. So there is something we're longing for, you know. that it's important to consider.
Yeah, we I guess in a way, this is just my experience of it. Is you know, I want to be a better person, and I think we all do, right?
Right.
And you know, I'm guilty of all of this stuff. You know, I'm like, if I'm on the bus.
Right. The bus is a great example.
Yeah. And you know, especially the time of day that you ride, you can, you know, it's a wide variety of people that you'll encounter.
And the area of the city is also, yeah.
Yeah. Wow, and so you make assumptions about people, and you really shouldn't, because I mean everyone the thing that I've been thinking about, even, you know, ever since, you know, my formative years, you know, after high school, say, when I've really tried to form how I interact with people and my attitude about life, is, you know, you have to remember that this is somebody, this is a person, this is someone's kid. It doesn't matter how old they are, right? I mean, that is someone's kid, right?
Yeah.
And you know, you think, well, okay, so this is a woman, or this is someone who's older, so I have to be more polite, say, because I'm a guy, right? Or I'm going to give up my seat.
Yeah.
But you know, at the same time, so as I've gotten older and I've, say, read more or talked to more people and interesting people over the years, you realize that it doesn't really matter. Things like gender, for example.
Yeah.
So if you are a person of in between, say if you showed up here today, well, I'd get the door for you, but not because, you know, you're a woman, but because, you know, you're a guest. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess that's why. I mean, you're obviously hearing from people who've read the book, and these things that they're thinking about. I mean, I'd assume that it's not dissimilar to what I've just clumsily tried to say.
Yeah, I think it's...
I mean, people have been... You have had thoughtful readers, haven't you?
I have, and also I've given a lot of readings, and of course, so there will be people in the audience who haven't read the book yet, don't even, you know, if it's a group reading or whatever, aren't even aware of it. So there is that whole kind of spectrum of people who have read it very deeply, writers and non-writers, to people who are hearing it for the first time, excerpts from it. And so I just go back to, this takes a lot of energy. It's almost like an armor we all have on, you know, to maintain the category that we are known in and identified with. And it's part of how we feel safe in the world and feel that there's predictability in the world, right? But a lot of it is illusion, and a lot of it is an impoverishment, really. And it causes a huge amount of conflict because there's this distrust. And it's, I don't know, just look at the world. I feel like it has the potential of really doing us in all kinds of ways.
This is talking about this armor, if you will. You write in the book how much about how much of ourselves we hide in order to fit in.
Yes.
So, I mean, you know, if one was completely comfortable, some people would like to just go out into the world, get on the bus, go to work in whatever clothes they slept in, right?
Yes.
For example. Yes. but some people, most people, I would assume, have to, you know, do the things that they'd have to do to, say, fit in at work. And, you know, whether that's, say, they're working at a business that mandates a uniform, or, you know, just hygiene, if you will, those sorts of things. You know, there are some people in the world who are uninhibited and put themselves out there in full display. Are they really? And if so, what do you think they know that the rest of us don't?
Well, I think there's many different reasons for what we would perceive as an uninhibited person. So there are many different motivations around that. And so I don't think we can get a simple answer for that one. I think that, to me, it's not about really being uninhibited exactly, because I think we tend to think, that word, for me anyway, tends to have a bit of a pejorative quality to it. And it may not be for you, but I think for me, what I experience in being comfortable about and being a person of between out in the world with other people is it's a kind of empathy and generosity, which is that's much more sort of low key and just natural human instinct, you know. So it's not really about being inhibited or uninhibited. I think it's deeper. It's on that level of and curiosity, empathy, curiosity, those levels. Yeah.
I guess what I was thinking about in terms of uninhibited was, you know, you've seen people like this who show up, you know, at a place and are, say, get out of my way, idiot, or something like that. You know what I mean? Or this is not what I ordered, and then send it back.
Yes.
Or very loud and laugh, you know, at restaurants, and you're just obnoxious, really.
Yeah.
But I guess that's an armor that they put up
because they're
too sensitive in another area of their life, perhaps.
Yeah, it's an armor, and I think it has a lot to do with life story in terms of, you know, circumstance that has shaped them. So it's complicated. That's a whole other, I think, area that we can't really address, you know, today.
Yeah.
But it is... I would only just say that what I'm talking about in being in terms of being comfortable being a person in between isn't really about now being uninhibited.
Yeah.
It's the opposite. It makes me more just at ease and more empathetic and more curious about others.
And does curiosity involve, say, going up to people and talking to them more easily than, say, before?
Totally.
Yeah,
I have yet to have that kind of those little openings happen and to just be there for them. I have yet to have the other person be offended or be reactive.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So it does sort of says to me this is really much truer to our nature as people to be this way.
You know, I've done this now, this interview show for 13 and a half, almost 14 years, and I notice when I go out, you know, I'm at a store or something like that, or a function, I end up talking to someone, and I find that's a lot more easier now, having done this for as long as I have.
Sure.
And I find that in the sort of questions I ask people, even the clerk who's ringing you up at the market or something like that, I guess I realize after doing this for so long that everyone has a story.
Oh, yes.
And maybe I'm just canvassing for guests, you know, trying to find people to talk to for this show.
Yeah.
That you know, you realize that. And I guess, that empathy has to come through, doesn't it? I mean, the world could use a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Always.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You also write about the struggle to find the time to write, and that's coupled with the need to make a living.
Yes.
That's something that you've dealt with through the years. Are you better at that now than say 10, 15, 20 years ago?
Well, you have to be adaptable as a writer. You just have to and so there was a period in my life where I could write more days than not in a week, and often for many hours of a stretch, and still be having enough money to pay the bills.
Mm-hmm.
Then that changed for a number of reasons, but probably the most significant reason was the birth of my son, who almost was very in a very critical condition for the first month of his life and almost died a couple times. And, when we brought him home from the hospital, we had to put all the baby books away because none of them they weren't any help for the baby we had, and yet we didn't know what was the situation at that point. And it took a while to actually figure out what was the situation. One of the aspects was that he was deaf. So he needed two full-time moms, which he had for the first 2 years of his life. It was imperative. He's now going to be 19, and he's a fabulous guy. But I had to change my writing practice completely. And so what? Because I would get maybe a half an hour,
mm-hmm.
rarely an hour, and I would get that kind of time, maybe 3 or 4 times max a week for over 2 years. So I had to learn how to write in shorter bits and dive in, and also to create a bigger project, a bigger narrative territory that would I could be diving in and out of over a much longer period of time. So, for example, Breathing the Page, it was almost a 13-year writing project. And Oscar Between is, I started in 2007. I finished in 2015, I think that's right.
So 8, 9 years, say?
Yeah. So I had to switch completely to a longer writing project and writing shorter pieces. So then for Oscar Between, I switched again to similar in terms of longer writing project and smaller narrative units. But what I did with Oscar Between is, which I started writing in London when I was on that trip in 2007, is to run away most of the time. Run away for a week or a weekend, max was 2 weeks to write throughout those years, because of the demands in my work life, and also family demands, not demands, but commitments.
Obligations,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, commitments. And so that's how I wrote this book. And this book is in 36 parts, and it takes place, you'll know, each part has a year and the location. So, for example, what I did was both in London and in Montreal, where I did quite a bit of the writing, but was to do a flat or apartment exchange, and I found these people in London and Montreal through a common friend, because I couldn't afford to go and pay. It had to be free. So what was cool about that is I kept returning to those cities in the same flat and knowing the area that I was staying in. And it was like sort of a watermark, like you could see what kind of concerns and images continued to reappear over the years in those locations, and which ones sort of fell away and new ones replaced them, and how it all evolved. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I knew I wanted to write this book in a form I had in a previous memoir, Bloodroots, which was one continuous narrative, but it had entries, and so the entries could be anywhere from one line on a page to dialogue to longer prose pieces. I wanted to go back to that form. I really loved working in it, and so I knew that. I knew I wanted to introduce one fictive device, and I didn't know what it would be and what it eventually became, because this name kept coming to me all the time, was Oscar. And, it's an old-fashioned name. You don't run into it very much. And I just was running into it all the time, and I just thought, okay, I think this is it. Oscar is going to be telling this story. So, and then within each part, there's numbered sections. And some of this, and they vary in length.
Mm-hmm.
So I was still working. I would write that whole part within that time period in that place, whether it was here in Vancouver in Hornby Island or various places. And then within that part 1 or part 18, there were entries of various lengths. So it was very, I call it a container, basically finding a container in which you can write in. Given the nature of the narrative and given the realities of your life.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean by adaptable.
Yeah. So when you look back, and now that Oscar Between is published, because it is about 10 years, this chunk of your life,
from
60 to 70. Looking back at it all, I mean, did you have answers about yourself that you now know that you wish you knew earlier, say? Or and I ask this because, you know, you started this when you turned 16, you went to England.
Mm-hmm.
As I was sitting here preparing for our interview, I thought, well, you know, 60 is probably a good age to get the answers that you're looking for, because I'm 34. And so I'm say just about half your age, right?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about these things all the time. I'm thinking about, you know, when I'm 60, when I'm 70, I'll probably have a better grasp of things, whether it's money or relationships or family life and the sort. So I'm curious to know if at 70 you know more now. Or you know yourself better, at least.
In some ways, yes, yes.
Yeah.
I think that's true. But in some ways, I'm more interested in the questions than the answers, because I feel life is a quest, and certainly mine has been. And so I'd say that maybe I've gotten more and more attuned to what are the really important questions, and then, you know, hanging out there with them and seeing what I find out, what they reveal. But even, like, as I mentioned, with the adaptability I've had to have as a writer, it's not as though you do get this one answer and then that's it for the rest of your life, you know. It's just, but it has this kind of resonance with you that you're willing to then be curious about how it will alter and intensify and deepen over time, you know? So I think it's more that for me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I find that the you ask one question and then that the answer, you know, inspires three, four, five different more questions. And I think that's what life is, isn't it? It's just, you know, you're moving along.
Yeah.
Picking up what you can and then...
So I'd say I become more and more comfortable with that, and that's really a great relief, and also very enjoyable most of the time. Sometimes scary, but you know, scary isn't bad.
No, it's not. Yeah. So you're picking up answers as you go along, and then you're someone who's also known in this town, in this community, as a mentor.
Yeah.
And you do that. With people's work, their writing. How has that enriched your life as a writer? I mean, because you have had to take time away from writing to help others with theirs.
Right.
I'm assuming it informs your process.
It does. It's enriched my life tremendously. It's like really just beyond expression. I was raised... My parents raised me with a very strong sense of community and being, involved in the community and being giving your time to the community. So that's always been a very strong part of my writing life. Mentoring, I have to earn a full-time living, and writers are really the poorest. The lowest income of any art form. Most of the time, everyone makes far more money on your book than you do. you know, it's just the only way I can be a professional writer is to do a lot of adjacent related work, teaching classes, you know, creating the writer's studio. I designed that and was the director of that for 12 years. And I will be going back as a mentor for 2017, which is really pleased to be asked back. The Vancouver Manuscript Intensive, creating ways to be active within the writing life, because you cannot be writing full time. That's just not a reality, and it's not a reality for most of writers in Canada. It's just not at all. So then, you know, what you shift to, or for me, what I shift to, is not only wanting to build community and support other writers. Because it's a hard work, hardest work I've ever known, writing. And so I want to be there for other writers. And I find it a very, I really see it almost in a spiritual way, that it, you know, when someone trust me with something that's so deeply important to them. And they still have a lot of questions about it, so there's a vulnerability around that. We both kind of go into that quest to figure out what has to happen with this manuscript, what is really strong in it, what is missing, what isn't working, and has to be pulled out. It's a very remarkable process. So it continually folds into my understanding about mm-hmm. writing mm-hmm. and my ideas around writing, and it's like this loop that's good for everyone concerned, really. So that's what it's about for me, besides earning a living, and partly how I do earn a living as a mentor and a manuscript developer and consultant.
So I've talked to a lot of writers over years, and they say, almost everyone says, that to be a good writer, you have to be a good reader. Now, I don't write. If I took up writing, do you think I'd be a better reader, say?
You don't necessarily, because what happens for quite a while when you first start writing, for most people, is that you're so amazed to see your own voice on the page or on the screen. You get quite preoccupied with that, and a little bit, to be honest, entranced. It's part of it. It's just part of getting your feet on the ground.
Yes.
And you can tell that kind of writing, right?
You see that all the time.
You're laughing.
Yeah.
So there's that. It's part of it. So then you start to get more curious once you get your feet on the ground, and it can take sometimes a number of years to get your feet on the ground, because it's a weird thing, you know, like contrasted to other art forms, writing is the more, it's the least abnormal activity, because we write in our lives and all kinds of work and, you know, mm-hmm. emails, et cetera. So it's a very normal daily activity, unlike, say, you know, casting a sculpture, bronze, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a very, it's almost this kind of having to rediscover it as an art form, because it's not an art form in daily life. And when you go into a cafe, for example, if you're a musician, you can tell that the musicians are carrying their instrument, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Or if you're a visual artist, they wear black.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, or there's always cues, but for writers, there's no cues. You can go into a cafe and there could be 10 people writing by hand or on their devices, and you think, oh my God, they're all writers. None of them are, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe three of them are. You don't know. So it's a very strange art practice and form and profession. But gradually, when if you're working with someone else in a class or whatever, so you should read it. You should read so and so, or you should read this book, and you should read that article. You start to find these kinds of companions in writers who sometimes you meet in person, or sometimes they've been dead for three centuries, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you start to find your, in a sense, you know, your soulmates that provoke you and make you want to learn from them and borrow from them. So that's kind of how it gradually happens.
And then one's voice emerges, I guess, right?
Yes, and so you know what you want to be after is whatever you're putting down on the page or you're writing on a device. You want to be constantly surprised by what's happening there. And if you're not, if it's pretty predictable, you haven't got out of that first phase of just getting your feet on the ground. Because when it starts to surprise you is when you are what I call the narrative is the boss, whether it's a poem or a short story or a novel or a creative nonfiction book-length manuscript. It's when you surrender to that narrative and it is the boss, and you're just trying to follow it and keep up with it. So your ego just goes right down the drain, you know, because if your ego otherwise will just, you won't even be able to hear what that narrative is requiring and what it has to tell you. It's secret in its way it has to live on the page. You won't even hear it.
So what I admire about writers a lot is how much, it can be hard work and it can be maddening and it can drive you nuts, I'm sure. But it does provide, and this is a sense I get from talking to you now about your book, it has provided one a sense of comfort, a sense of belonging, and perhaps, and I'm reaching now, making life a little bit more bearable.
I like that, more bearable. Yes and no. It's hard work, and there's of course a lot of the writing community or industry is like any other in many ways. There are a lot of personal power dynamics and, you know, economic pressures that make it, particularly in the last decade in the literary community, the mm-hmm. publishing community, make it much harder. There's just regular real life stuff. You run into there just like anywhere else. And so there's that. I think what makes, you know, if I can loop that bearable sort of thought you've got there,
yeah.
I think that you're onto something about that, because there is a sort of, when I'm writing,
yeah.
there's hardly anything else like it. It can be scary, it can be hard work, but it is amazing. It's
yeah.
amazing. It's like you're outside of time, that's one thing. Time just, you're just outside of it. You're in another zone of reality, and you know, everything in you is alert, and every kind of aspect of your lived being is alert, and you know, if you're writing in a place where, you know, you're not in a refugee camp or whatever, you know,
yeah.
that you actually feel safe, it's a rare experience. It's a rare experience to feel those sensations, and it's a rare experience to see something appearing gradually, word by word, letter by letter, on the page or on the screen, that is like a voice that is trusting you, right?
Yeah.
And so there's aspects about it that do, I think, do make life more bearable. Yeah.
So this past spring, you received this award from the city.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like in terms of being recognized by this community? Because I understand that you have written about your relationship with this community over the years. It's left you out at times.
Yeah, it has. I haven't actually written about it very much over the years. This is really the first time in this book I have. There's been just a little bit before. I felt it was important to write about that aspect because it happens for other writers, and it's going to happen for other writers. So I felt I owed it to them to say, hey, if you run into this, it does happen. This is what I've learned to understand about it. My part of it, in terms of the community, part of the bigger world we live in, that the pressures that puts on us as writers, which are considerable,
mm-hmm.
And not easy to deal with. So I felt that was, I had the belly up to the bar and say, yeah, this is part of this could be part of your writing life. Don't idealize it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of what you asked, but can you repeat the question, because there was another part of it?
Because you got this award recently, and
yes,
one assumes, that here is this community, this literary community in
yeah.
Vancouver, honoring you for your life's work, if you will. I mean, that's probably a nice thing, I'm assuming, but at the same time, you have to reconcile the fact that for a while, it turned its back on you, say.
Yeah, and not everybody, not the whole community,
yeah.
but certainly important.
But you certainly felt
yeah.
out, right?
Yes,
you felt.
Yes. But, you know, what I came to understand over a long period of time is my part in that, you know, and And true, and actually, part of it was this. Not understanding the uncertainty that people felt because I didn't fit into any one category. Mm. I did sometimes for briefly, but then didn't. So, plus other things. I chose to be basically self-trained, which used to be much more common and is not common now at all. That's the way I started off, and I really felt that was the right fit for me. And I still think it was, because I tend to be, I'm a loner in some ways, you know?
Yeah.
And like my father was a very successful businessman, but he was completely self-taught. And so I had that as an example in my life, and I saw what was hard about that for him, but also the freedom it gave him, you know? And so that's partly my nature. Partly I realized there is a kind of freedom in, so every time I would apply for a grant and not get one, I always felt two things. I felt like, oh, man, this is tough, and the other part of me said, oh, well, at least I'm not responsible for that or that funding organization,
yeah.
You know? So I always felt both of those things. But it was hard as time went on because I realized I was really at a serious economic disadvantage compared to my other writers, my peers, like seriously. But this award wasn't from the literary community. It's important to clarify that. It was. There are three writers, who have all previously received the award as in theater, as in
jurors, dance, right?
Whatever. Yeah, so they've all received it. They are the jurors. And they come up with names as well as some people send in names. And I had some writers I know send in by recommendation the previous year and this year. So the literary community was involved, but it wasn't really from the literary community. It was from the city. Right?
Yeah.
So I was stunned. I was shocked. I really, not to be honest, saying that I didn't deserve it, but I never thought that.
Yeah.
I never thought this was going to be something that happened in my life. So I was stunned. And then when I got up to give you had 1 minute to receive it, and which of course some people went on longer than that. But I'm big at saying that that's with 1 minute. I want to stay within that, be courteous. And I was watching several people go up. I'm sure, never doubted they're deserving this. But they have received a number of awards, and they kind of knew how to do it, right?
Yeah.
They just knew how to rattle it off and, be charming and all these things. I just thought, I can't do that. I don't know how to do that, So when I got up, I didn't know what I was going to say initially. I had some ideas once I got rolling, but I didn't know how I was going to start. And I got up to the podium and I said, I just have to acknowledge I'm unaccustomed to receiving awards and I'm feeling really shy right now. And it really helped me to say, I'm really feeling shy right now.
Yeah.
I'm not going to come across as this sort of, eloquent, top of my game person, right?
Yeah.
So, but then what was really important to say came to me, and I felt good about it. And a number of people said, they really appreciated what I had to say. So it worked out fine, but it was very nerve-wracking. It was just like, I was a newbie, totally, in that situation. And I couldn't any later imitate people who this has been much more a part of their artist production life. So I had to find, my own way how to do it.
Yeah.
So it was nerve-wracking. But the thing that was so wonderful about it is to see all the different kinds of, across the board, the art right now that's being produced in the city, and who are some of the people who are doing that. And that was just thrilling. It was very inspiring.
Well, was there a little part of you that was glad you got it because it showed up all the people that say turned their back over the years?
No, actually not. No, didn't feel that way. I can't even tell you why. I can't explain why, but it didn't feel that way at all. I think it's much more humble than that. It's just a gratitude for just feeling more included, you know? So it was more like that. And because each honoree can choose an emerging, that was a really important part of it, and I really respect that about the city, that it does this. And then there's a small sum of money, but, you know, helpful, that's given to both, equal amount. So I chose Yonina Curtin, who I wasn't part of saying, let's take her into the studio in the application process starting in 2007. And she's originally from Winnipeg, as a mix of Métis and Icelandic. And I worked quite a lot on her manuscript, and it came out as a book last year, and it's doing extremely well, the first book. And it was just a joy. It was just a joy to, you know, do this together, you know, like both be standing up there together, because you don't get to see that very often, too, that sense of how we help each other and how we inspire each other, and just to honor that and to, you know, so that was quite wonderful, too, that part of it.
So as part of Read Local BC, all of you authors are local authors speaking to the community. We're all talking about just how difficult it is to live in this town. It's bloody expensive and the sort.
Really?
But so as a writer, what's kept you here all these years?
Probably, my grandparents all came from Norway, so this landscape just, it's in my DNA, right? This ocean, the mountains, the forest. So I feel very comfortable here and love it. So I think it's number one is the actual natural environment. When I was in Edmonton, which is a landscape more similar to where I grew up, and there's so many things wonderful about Edmonton and the art scene there and the writing scene, so I don't want to be misleading people. But I find that that landscape, I find it really hard. It has its beauty, and the sky is amazing, but it's so, everything is got the, is under the control, pretty much, of human beings, everything. And I wouldn't survive. wouldn't survive if I had to lived in the landscape I grew up in, decade after decade. I really need this, strength and vibrancy of the natural world. So Vancouver is wonderful that way. You know, you've got the city, and you are just, you can be up in Cyprus snowshoeing in, 35 minutes?
Yeah.
It's incredible. I also loved it because it was when I first came out here, it was the kind of the locus of the most innovative experimental writing that was going on, and that's always been a strong part of my writing life. So I loved it for that too. So I guess those are the two top things that come to my mind.
How do you assess the writing community now? I mean, I talked to all, you know, I talked to a lot of writers in this town, and I find, you know, there are cliques in the sort.
Yes, oh yes.
So that's still there, right?
Oh yeah, it's still there, and that's true anywhere. How do I assess the writing community now? Well, it's become much more diverse, which I'm very grateful for. Diverse in many ways. Like for instance, when I came on the scene here as an out lesbian, there were very, very, very few other writers, just a handful. You know, so The difference between that and now is really major. The difference between writers in the city are we have much more country of origin, first language not being English, racial background, religious background. It's just much, much more diverse, and I love that. Just totally love it. And it's one of the things that the Writer's Studio, when I was designing it, wanted to really attract a spectrum of writers, and we have consistently. All that's excellent. It's just not the easiest time to be a writer because, and that's just going across the board.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what's happening, for example, with Reading the Page, I knew that book was going to do well. And it's about the act of writing and a lot of concepts I developed or borrowed from visual arts and exercises and also the materials we work with as writers, like dealing with them as animate co-creators with us, like the pencil. I'm very much in love with the pencil, for example. Mm. And with each pencil can write 42,000 words. Now, that's pretty amazing technology. Cheap, too, you know. So, but, you know, when I was looking, when I was shopping that manuscript around, I had publishers, senior editors love it, and every time marketing said no.
Hmm.
So what we're dealing with in the English-speaking world is that marketing, particularly it's true in North America, marketing is making the editorial decisions more and more. And so finally, one publisher loved it so much, he said, I'll help you find another publisher. And this is unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
And we both thought, well, maybe this publisher might be good. And he talked to that publisher initially, and then I sent the publisher an email and sample, and that's what became, that was the publisher that took the manuscript. And it became a bestseller.
Yeah.
But that was 5 years. And that's one of the reasons I started the online excerpts from the manuscript and inviting guest writers and artists, visual artists and composers from around Canada, outside of Canada, to bounce off what I was posting each month. And, I have to create a different pathway for myself, and I've totally loved doing it. And then, ironically, it was being followed by the publicist at Caitlin Press, Andrea Rootley, and she talked to Vicki Johnson, the publisher, and said, I think you should look at this manuscript. And that's how it became a book. So it was a whole different method and a whole different set of, got rid of a lot of assumptions and expectations and just wrote it. And felt it's been very thrilling to do. And it's thrilling now to have it as a book.
Yeah, well, I just got it this morning, as I said, and so I can't wait to have at it. And this hour that we've spent now has just whizzed by. And I can't thank you enough for the time, and I'm sure we'll talk after I finish reading this book, because I'll have probably just as many questions then as I do now.
Well, I'd love to, and you've got great questions, Joe, I really appreciate talking with you.
The same. All the best and congratulations on everything.
Thank you.
The website for more, BetsyWorland.com. The book is called Oscar of Between, A Memoir of Identity and Ideas. It's from Dagger Editions, which is an imprint of Caitlin Press. Betsy Worland, its author, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.